Welcome, Action fans, and thanks for joining us for another edition of All 90s Action All the Time, as we continue this year's journey of looking at some of the best, worst, wackiest, and most underappreciated action films of 1993. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and joining me once again is my regular co-host, you know who he is. It's screenwriter, comedian, and roguish criminal with a heart, Mr. Craig Drine.
That's
what you had to do. Yeah, that's.
There are a lot of good lines to use from this movie, but yeah, the laugh is the essential part.
The laugh is the quintessential part of any movie starring Christopher Lambert. So, if, in case you didn't understand what that laugh was all about, listeners, in case you hadn't looked this up, this movie, it's a Christmas. But what is today's movie? Well, it is Gunmen.
In a South American country, bad man coming from a bad land. An ex-cop is about to lead a team of mercenaries.
Let's do this business.
Rob, please don't send me off with a superhero that looks like Whoopi.
Are you going to do the job or not?
To take down a drug lord.
How the hell are you?
For these guys, there's only one way to settle the score. Point blank.
Jump out of a helicopter? What do you mean, in a rubber?
You a sick mother, man.
At least the high cholesterol, if you don't let it out. This way, are we?
No!
Mario Van Peebles. Christopher Lambert. Dennis Leary. Kadeem Hardison. Big Daddy Kane. Rakim. Eric B. Gunman.
Which was directed by Darren Serafian, who is most famous for directing the Jean-Claude Van Damme film Death Warrant and the Charlie Sheen skydiving actioner Terminal Velocity. And it was written by Stephen Sommers, who would go on to direct the likes of Deep Rising, The Mummy, and The Mummy Returns. Critic-wise, it is currently sitting on a 5.2 out of 10 on IMDb, a really rotten 15% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 13 reviews. It has no Metacritic score, and it has a 2.6 on Letterboxd. Box office-wise, it made $3.4 million off of an estimated $8 million budget, which it seems like it was a bit of a flop, but you just never know. If that figure seems, that kind of gross seems very much the North American gross. I don't know how much it was worldwide, maybe a bit more, and maybe it made its money back on VHS. But it has been largely forgotten since it has been released. You may have also noticed that I usually mention the release date of the film at the top there, but I didn't. It's a bit of a confusing thing. So this movie was filmed in 1992, had something of a cinema release in Hungary and Italy in 1993, but the US and most of the rest of the world did not see this film until 1994. However, when initially scheduling this film, I didn't know any of that, and had just gone off the IMDb year that they put on their page, which was 1993. So that's why it's in this year's season of films rather than next year's season of films. So there you go. So if you were confused, if you saw the Wikipedia page that says 1994, and you're like, well, it shouldn't be covering it this year. Well, that's why. Okay, so that's all cleared up. But that doesn't matter. What really matters is it is a big day for the podcast. And listeners, you might not be aware it is a big day. Because, as I mentioned, this film stars the one, the only, Christopher Lambert, France's greatest action star, and one of my co-hosts, Craig's favorites. And it's taken a mere 2 years to get to one of his films. But Craig is a very patient man, and he's very excited. So, yeah. Craig, tell us about your relationship with the movies of Christopher Lambert.
So, I mean, yeah, from when I was young, I'm not, even to this day, I'm not big on franchise type stuff. Like, I'll watch them, whatever. But I'm not a big franchise person except for Highlander franchise. For some reason, despite the continuity issues that run rampant in all of those movies, and we won't get into all of that, but I would watch those movies constantly. And yeah, I'm not sure how my parents didn't notice all the, like, the sex scenes and stuff like that. They probably, yeah, but even at a very young age. And so, like, specifically Mortal Kombat, I watched because I wanted to see it won, but also Christopher Lambert plays Raiden amazingly, even though he's probably very miscast. And yeah, I just watched, I don't know what it is about him, and it's very peak him in this film that we're discussing today, where I guess it's just this kind of wily charisma, and he doesn't really fit with other action stars of the time in some way. Like, there's just something about him that's very unique compared to some, you know, some of the other people we talk about, in my mind, of course, but that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I guess he does bring quite a, like, unique energy, whether, you know, The Highlander is his most famous film, and I rewatched that for the umpteenth time last year. And he doesn't quite fit the action mold. I do feel like there's some actors who have become action stars that rub up against, like, the kind of the natural notion of what we think an action star is, and makes kind of quirky, weird choices. I am reminded of the season that we did on Val Kilmer,
yeah,
who, again, I think is somebody similar, that, like, was trying to be put in an action box, but was in it, but, like, kind of never quite fully fit, but, like, brought something interesting to the mix. Although I think overall Christopher Lambert's done a lot more action than Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I really, and we'll kind of talk about this within the movie itself, but at least the ones I've seen, and it might be not as true, especially when you get further into the Highlander films or stuff like that, but he always, it seems like he commits, and I know we talked about this before recording, but yeah, it's just, never feels like he's phoning it in as much as many other action stars could. And yeah, I think there's always just been just that uniqueness about him that,
yeah,
I enjoy. It makes for a good movie. And even if it's supposed to be a very serious action film he's in, somehow it turns funny because of his laugh and because of everything else.
Yeah, he's very... like, he kind of brushes things off in an interesting, yeah, way. Like, no matter, like, how no matter how grave things are, there's always a kind of shrug of the shoulders and a kind of, like, well, you know, we go on to the next thing. You know, yeah. It's just like, it's very interesting. And he does bring, I don't know, he always has that kind of, like, glint in his eye, and there's always, like, a little bit of irony there. I quite like him as a presence as well, because, yeah, I think I am attracted to, I think we've discussed this before, that, like, the uber serious, the kind of self-serious, what I call, like, self-serious stupid movies, where, like, they're over the top action movies, but they're quite humorless, and like, they seem to believe that they're very serious, even though, or believe that they have weight, even though they're completely weightless.
be our first season with an asterisk. Steven Seagal season.
I know, but like the great thing about Steven Seagal movies is that he's very serious, but nobody. Yeah, it's Steven Seagal movies are like Fast and the Furious movies, where like you know, like Vin Diesel thinks it's a serious family drama, but everybody around him knows exactly what movie is. And Steven Seagal movies are like that. That's why those movies still work. Yeah. But the movies that I'm not so gravitated towards are the you know, the kind of very grim face. Like, I always kind of avoided like the kind of most of the Chuck Bronson movies, most of the Chuck Norris movies, most of the Tom Berenger kind of movies. Like, they're all kind of grim faced, pretty vacuum packed of humor and irony. So like, I quite, and I think this is the thing about Christopher Lambert that like rubs some people up the wrong way. And what I really enjoy about him, I like kind of action stars who look like they're having fun. I think that's why probably my favorite action star of the 21st century is Jason Statham, who is a man who knows exactly how ridiculous all his movies are.
Well, I'm surprised because he kind of, you know, with Lambert, he, at least for the United States, you know, stayed, is known within these action movies and all this stuff, but he is one that I'm surprised didn't like really go into a full, as far as I know, a full comedy kind of like what we see with Sylvester Stallone, which then failed, or what we see with, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger had his little comedy phase, but Lambert seems like he could have done it.
Or, I think so. And I have to say, I don't know his filmography extensively. I don't know if he's done a bunch of more straightforward comedies in France, because I know he's done like a mixture of like American films, Hollywood films, and French films. So I don't really know. I have seen a bunch of his American films, but I've not really seen any of his French films. So I don't really know what they are. So maybe he did some of that. But yes, let's talk about Christopher Lambert in this movie, Gunman. And I think, or should we actually, before we fully get into the plot of the movie, we'll talk about the plot of the movie in a minute. Should we just kind of run through kind of who's in this movie? Because like it's quite a fun kind of cast. And we've got like lots of people who are kind of really in their strength, who are really at their peak at this in this time. Because so we've got Christopher Lambert, who, you know, was still riding high. You know, Highlander might have been 1986, but like he was still pretty famous at the time. We've got Mario Van Peebles, who's only a couple of years removed from New Jack City. And we've got Patrick Stewart, who's like, I don't know what stage we're in with Star Trek Next Generation. I think we're in maybe season 4 or 5, something like that.
Wasn't it? It was right before First Contact, was it? Or was it kind of as the show was ending first movie?
So yeah, the first movie. Yeah, no, it was kind of towards the end. It was kind of towards the end of. Yeah, so maybe even later, like this is kind of towards the end of the TNG, because Generations, Star Trek Generations, would have come out in 1994, which in American cinemas, this movie came out in 1994 as well. So like, you know, when he was filming, you know, back in 1992, that would have been like season 5 or something.
Okay,
but like, yeah, I think we're coming right towards the end of TNG at this stage in Generations, when they come out in 1994, so he's pretty hot. And then Dennis Leary, he's had his success with his comedy album No Cure for Cancer, I think is 1992. And like he has a bunch of movies that were 1993, including this and Judgment Night. And Demolition Man, so he's at the peak of his powers here. And even some of the more minor characters, Like, she was never a big star, but Brenda Back had a notable appearance in Hot Shots Part 2 only a couple of years before this. So she was probably a face people knew as well at the time. And yeah.
I saw it was a pretty
good cast.
The pilot, I can't remember his name now, but
Kareem Hardison.
Yeah. Now I've seen, yeah, I saw him before. I was like, oh, he's in stuff that I've watched, but like, then I couldn't remember anything at the time.
Or it's called him Kareem. It's Kadeem Hardison.
Okay.
I don't know what he's. I know he's in stuff, like a movie I've never seen. But I've wanted to see for a while is called Drive. I know he's in that with Mark Dacascos. Apparently he played Dwayne Wayne on the television series A Different World, which was a spin-off of The Cosbys. I don't know. That was never aired in the UK. A Different World. I don't know. Was that something you knew?
I don't know. Yeah. but what I will say about the cast, I know I already hinted at it and we'll mention it probably throughout, is that all of them too, they're in the stride, but they're all really, they seem to all really be committing, or at least know the type of movie that they're in.
Yeah.
which it works in that sense. Yeah.
He does. Oh, apparently Kadeem Hardison was also I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Okay, that would be it.
I probably saw a scene him in that. I don't remember what character he played, but I've definitely seen him in that. getting back to this movie, I guess. If listeners are interested, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. Very fun film. Do it in a double bill with Black Dynamite. You're going to have a great night.
Yes.
I guess when talking about the cast, we should talk about the unusual cameos that this film has. Because this film was a movie made in the early 90s. And the early 90s were all about jumping on the kind of urban ghetto film craze, and even though that this is not an urban film, it takes place in quote unquote South America, although filmed in Mexico. And there's just a bunch of random cameos by rappers. And there is a club called the Crazy Ace where we see performances by popular rappers of the time, including Big Daddy Kane and Eric B. and Rakim, which is complete. I don't know why they added this to the film, but it is a very fun element of just like, that's the thing that's happening.
So there were so many points in my notes I wrote. I might as well just say it now. It takes place in South America. I went, but where does this actually take place? Because there's all these different elements thrown in that don't feel South America at all. Like at some points, you're like, oh, maybe this is Miami. No, it's South America. It says South America. Oh, maybe it's like Mexico area. Nope. Okay. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, I think maybe some of it is like Miami or something. Because it does say that, I don't know. It says at the beginning of the film, and at the end of the film, filmed in the United States and Mexico. No filming took place in any South American country. And they're very inspecific about things, because when they when the things pop up, it just says kind of like South America.
Yeah.
It doesn't really give a country. It's not like they're in Bolivia or they're in Argentina or whatever. You know, it's just like, South America. Somewhere Amazon-y, yes.
Where everybody is speaking purely just English.
Just English. Nobody speaks Spanish. Yeah. Nobody speaks Spanish at all. For some reason. And that the ethnicity thing's interesting as well, because it seems like they make a kind of deal as if Danny, Christopher Lambert's character, like basically grew up in wherever in specific place in South America they are. And yet Danny is not, he's not like Hispanic at all. He's not, or I mean, I know there's lots of white people who live in South America as well, but like, I don't know, like they're just, like they're very inspecific about ethnicities in this film, I feel.
Yeah.
Everything's kind of very, very vague.
It seems like it's a big, it gets like many elements that we'll get into, like a marketing choice. You're like, okay, well, let's just not, let's make this as general as possible to appease the largest audience we can.
That is true. I think that before we get into it, and I know we've talked about the film a little so far, but we're not really spoiled anything. So I'll give the official spoiler warning now, even though I should have given it earlier. So sorry about that. So we are going to talk about everything in this film. There will be spoilers. We will talk about the end. We'll talk about everything. So if you've not seen the film, you fancy seeing the film, then you can go and watch it wherever you can find it. There, you know, if you're in the States, you can watch it on Tubi. If you're anywhere else, you can either buy it on DVD or there is a copy on YouTube. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that, but it's there and it's not being taken down and it was uploaded ages ago. So presumably the distributors don't care either. So like, that's the thing. So to kind of give everybody like an idea of what basic setup we're getting is, it's a very simple plot. There is a drug lord called Loomis, played by Patrick Stewart. He has lost a literal boatload of money because he basically had $400 million that he was transporting on a boat. And somebody stole that boat, and now everybody's looking for the boat. Who is looking for the boat? Well, we've got Armour, played by Dennis Leary, and a bunch of mercenaries that the Armour is the leader of, who Loomis orders to try and find the money. We also have Danny, played by Christopher Lambert, who is a thief, and it's his brother who stole the money. And he knows where the boat is, but he does not know the name of the boat. Who knows the name of the boat? Well, DEA agent Cole Parker, played by Mario Ben Peebles, he knows the name of the boat. So,
this but not the location.
Not the location. So this wacky duo of the thief and the DEA agent, they have to team up and find the money before the Mercs find the money for the drug dealer. So that's your basic setup. And while watching the movie, I did think this is quite entertaining that, like, I presume the pitch of the movie is like somebody just walked in to an office and they said, I know people are doing a lot of lethal weapon rip-offs, and we also want to do a lethal weapon rip-off. But what about, as a twist, we rip off The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly at the same time? Yeah. And then people just gave them money. They're like, oh, yeah, that's a fun twist on the lethal weapon rip-off formula. Yeah.
I didn't even think about that, but that makes a lot of sense. Because I was trying to, I was like, man, was this during the same, because there was the Damon Wayans, Adam Sandler one, there was a ton of...
Oh, Bulletproof? Where, yeah, that came out a few years later. That was like 96. Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember there was that run of movies where it was always the cop, and then it's like the buddy comedy, but at the cop and the criminal.
Yeah.
That we would sporadically see throughout the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. The weird subgenre that is non-existent now.
Yeah, I think it was, and it was always very, because it always followed the kind of 48 hours lethal weapon formula.
Yeah.
You've got to have one black guy, one white guy, one's got to be the straight man, one's got to be crazy, and that's a formula that's very much locked in what you had to be. And it didn't matter if the black guy was the crazy one or the white guy was the crazy one, but it just had to be, one of them had to be mental and one of them, you know, because obviously in 48 hours, Eddie's the crazy one. But Lethal Weapon, Mel's the crazy one too. So they switch it up, I guess. I guess that's there's all these little tweaks. You know, it's the same films, but it's all these little tweaks. That's when you really got in.
And well, we'll get to we'll get into that part more. But the movie, I think the movie has an amazing opening. I'll say that it's very peak Lambert, as we talked about before recording. But
I immediately got a laugh from the very, very beginning of the movie, even before we were introduced to Lambert. Because when we get the opening shot of the prison, it says Boa Vista, South America, present day. Yeah. And I laughed at that because I was like, yeah, we haven't had a flashback. So, like, I assumed it was present day. I mean, I don't know why you're telling me that movie.
Yeah. And there are no flashbacks in the entire movie. So.
No, there is not. There's not even like a 3 weeks earlier or whatever. Like,
And so you have a fly. So it basically opens silent for the most part with a fly landing on Lambert's mouth and going around. He's in a prison cell, and they quickly he's fast enough to catch the fly in his mouth, eat it, and then he spits it out. And then his kind of prison cellmate, the one next to him, laughs, and then he does his famous Christopher Lambert laugh. And then the guy checks, he's like tallying up apparently how many flies he could catch. So that's some game they're playing. And that is the cold opening, I guess, before we get the opening credit.
And we get a great early 90s rap song called Bite the Bullet by Kid Floss. Not a rapper I've heard of. Not a song I heard. But it's a pretty cool theme song. Like, I liked it. And we get like we get one of those classic early 90s, the title of the movie kind of whooshes onto the screen, and it's in this kind of bright, bold, yellow lettering. And yeah, I was like, oh, this is peak early 90s shit right here.
Yeah. So after the credits, so this is where it feels like there's a good 20 or 30 minutes that were taken out of the movie, in my opinion, because the editing feels chunky throughout and choppy, and we'll get into that. But it basically just jumps right into everything. There's really not any sort of a build to it.
No, we're told right away that about the money being stolen. Patrick Stewart's just like orders the Mercs to find his money. And then like Mario Van Peebles immediately bursts Christopher Lambert out of jail. Like, he doesn't like, it does feel like that there could have been like a couple of setup scenes of like just Van Peebles at the DEA office getting some details on Danny or Patrick Stewart finding out his money's been stolen or whatever. But like, it's just, everything's on fast forward. So we just like really jump into the action, which kind of works, but like, it does feel, you do feel like kind of like a bit kind of taken out of like, whoa, okay, right. Yeah. We're doing it already. All right, fine. Yeah. I've just sat down, but yeah, all right. Yeah. You know, like.
Yeah. Well, and it feels that way too, in a sense, because by what would be the midpoint of the movie, I was like, oh, this movie must be close to over or something, or kind of heading towards the end. And I checked the time, and it was still only 30 minutes in. It has this kind of, because it went so fast forward, like, it then hits this point where it almost feels like it should have ended by the 50-minute mark. Like, oh, we still have like 40 minutes left, kind of, not including the 10 minutes of credits, basically.
But, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Like, the early going kind of fast forward so much that I kind of did the same thing about kind of like 40 minutes in. I was like, can't be that much. What? Like, tap? Like, what did he? Because I was kind of confused. I was like, what are they going to do in the second half of the movie? Like,
yeah.
It feels like we're just about to wrap up, you know, like it's, It feels like they had enough material to, like, basically fill a television episode.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like an hour of television. And by an hour of television, I mean, like, the kind of television hour in America in, like, the 90s. Like
the 45 where, minutes.
Where it should be, like, 45 minutes, you know? Like,
yeah. Exactly. But I did like the open. So, yeah, I did like the opening with Patrick Stewart. So his character is kind of the cartel leader, but he's also very sickly. You don't really know what he has, but he's in a wheelchair and needs to be carried around and stuff like that. But he's talking about his money being taken to Dennis Leary's character, Armor. And then they just randomly, you see a woman gagged and tied up being put into a grave, which you find out is Loomis, Patrick Stewart's wife. You don't know why, and they're just burying her alive, and all he says is he talks about that he values trust. Like, so yeah. They're just kind of watching his, I guess, soon to be dead wife being buried alive while they're having this conversation. And there is, so for, it's because it's very comical, but yet there is a lot of brutal moments that, yeah, that kind of juxtapose with it.
Yeah, that's what I got from that. I was like, totally, that this is a bit confusing, yeah. Because, like, this is all kind of played for laughs. Like, you know, we've got Patrick Stewart kind of chewing up the scenery and Dennis Leary equally chewing up the scenery while this woman is being buried alive. And, like, this, you know, like, visually, when you're watching, like, this bride being dragged to this open grave and then start to be buried alive, it's like, this is some dark Peckinpah, bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia shit.
Yeah.
And yet it's all kind of played in this kind of wacky doodle kind of, like, you know, kind of, one, you know, quipping one liners. And you're like, this is weird to watch. Like,
And that's consistent throughout the whole thing, is that the whole time I was like, this is, I can't take my eyes off of it. It's so weird. It's just something weird, off about it, but I don't know. It was also very fascinating, maybe because of that. And because of, I guess, they're all chewing up the scenery.
Like you say, everything's on fast forward. Van Peebles, like, gets Lambert out of prison really quickly. Just, there's no issue with that. He just blows up a wall. They drive off. They start bickering. They bicker throughout the movie. That just is a running theme because, like, it's a buddy comedy. There's got to be a lot of bickering. He takes him back to the DEA outpost. Lambert almost immediately escapes from there, and then he has to try and track Danny down again, which he does at a brothel, which, again, is something we need to talk about, because Danny has an experience with a sex worker who is the world's most over-enthusiastic sex worker, and who, hilariously, is listed in the credits as Orgasmic Hooker. You want to talk about that scene, Craig?
Yeah, so the scene it is, again, I guess the word of the day is weird, because she's very over the top, and you'd think, and her reaction to him. And
he's not moving at all. Yeah. He's just watching her going, like, I don't understand.
Yeah, and he has his clothes on. She's, well, topless. But, yeah, I guess that's where it kind of, a part of the humor adds to it, is it's very aware of how she's acting, because he's just making faces of, this is really crazy right now. And he makes a lot of faces throughout. and then she kind of she slaps him, bends over, and then apparently she was hired by Mario Van Peebles' character, Cole Pohl, to get information from him. And Cole was just hanging out under the bed the whole time. So instead of just grabbing him from at first, when he found him,
I don't know.
He decided to wait it out.
Yeah, he decided to watch him have sex and then just crawl from under the bed and and point a gun at its head in a sneaky fashion.
But
yeah,
so and
the wackiness continues.
Yeah. And that's the weird thing. So their relationship is, so I think the two have decent enough chemistry for this movie. But they weirdly are very forgiving of each other despite everything that happened, because they'll kind of try and double cross one another, but then they end up almost just apologizing later on, and kind of all of these different, these quick turnarounds of their relationship constantly happen. And after the brothel, they're forced to, which becomes another recurring trend, of jump out of the building, not that part, but in falling into water.
Yeah,
there's a lot of them jumping into water elements, but because the team of mercenaries are able to find them, and they start kind of shooting up the room, and so they jump into the water and they escape. But Lambert's character is able to get the gun. So
we should mention that Dennis Leary character has been explicitly ordered to get these people, because they know where the boat is.
Yeah.
You know? Because like Dennis Leary's men are the one woman, Maria, played by Brenda Buck. So Dennis Leary's people, they're not the brightest. The person who stole the boat, Carlo, they immediately kill. Apparently, without really asking him that much about where the boat is.
They cut out his tongue.
And
then cut off his hands before asking him, before getting any information.
Yes. So they're all psychopaths. And who apparently have no regard for actually getting the money back. And they just like shoot up the brothel. Like, they just like machine gun the floors, the roof the roof of the bar that they're in, which is the floor of the room where Christopher Lambert and Mary Van Peebles' characters are. And like, they could have killed them like so many times. And yet they were explicitly told to just capture them and get the information.
Yeah. Because they are the only two with any information on where this boat is at. So if they were to die, they would never find. And the boat is could be anywhere in the world. It's not just, it's nearby. They have literally no clue of where it's at.
I think we should mention that kind of everybody's an idiot in this movie. Because, Patrick Stewart's character, Loomis, who is apparently a criminal mastermind, this massive drug dealer who has amassed $400 million, is, still dumb enough that he transported all of his money on one boat. Like, he didn't think to split it up. He didn't think to have some in reserve or anything. Just, he's now broke.
Yeah. And it even gets to the point where, as we get into it, of like him, like, should he sell his mansion or stuff like that just to pay his guards and all of his mercenaries, stuff like that. But it was because even Cole, who is supposed to be, I guess, the straight man to Danny, he has a lot of points where he's just also not the brightest. Like, he starts out, and he's the one with all of his stuff together. He was special forces, like all this stuff you learn. But then, he's kind of fumbling around as well.
Yeah, because he gets like that kind of what I would call like a Steven Seagal-esque kind of info dump kind of moment where like Dennis Leary tells the audience basically what a badass this guy was, how decorated he was in special forces, before going on to being a DEA agent. Like, he's He's the best dude around.
And his amazing cop father was killed by, what was it? Basically another member of the force selling him out. And
Yeah. But also, like, he was, so he has like this great lineage as well, where he's like the son of like this great hero cop, and he was the greatest special forces guy. And I think we should mention as well, though, like, in a very early 90s way, Mario Van Peebles does look cool as hell.
He does. No, I agree. He does look cool, and he does have the, I guess, in the same way as all the rest of the cast or whatever, that he does kind of have the leading man aesthetic.
And yes.
Like, it's not like he's outshined by Lambert or, well, yeah, I guess mainly just Lambert, but the other actors.
No, I don't think he's really, I mean, I think that they work well off each other. I think that Lambert does steal the movie.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, Mario Van Peebles kind of acquits himself quite well, and clearly has his own charisma as well.
Yeah.
So you're not bored when it's focusing on Mario Van Peebles searching for Danny, or like scenes where he's on his own. And so you're not just thinking, oh, God, I wish Christopher Lambert was here. You know, you are kind of going along with the film, but like, when Christopher Lambert is there, it takes it off. It's really quite fun. Also, like, I did a recording a wee while back on somebody else's podcast, also on the Last of Action Heroes Network, where we covered Highlander. And I didn't realize until I was reading a bit about Highlander how short-sighted Christopher Lambert is. And that's why he does this kind of squinty thing. He's, like, really short-sighted. And he has, like, injured himself on a bunch of films because in the 90s he did do, in the 80s and 90s he did do a lot of his own stunts.
Yeah.
So he's injured himself a bunch of times because he is severely short-sighted. Like,
I didn't know that.
So he can see hardly anything without his glasses. It's not necessarily like an acting choice to do the kind of famous squinty thing he does.
He's trying to see.
That was a fact that I just learned last year.
Danny gets the gun from from Cole, and it becomes where they're in the jungle of undisclosed somewhere in South America, and there's just kind of a series of little gags for a bit where Cole is, in quotes, sleeping and trying to give is sleep talking and kind of about to say the name of the boat, but he's doing it like he's talking to a woman and saying, just give me a kiss, I'll give the name of the boat. And so there's a whole drawn out scene of Danny preparing to kiss Cole. And it goes on, it feels like longer, the gag goes on longer than it needs to.
Some of the gags work and some of the wacky moments work for me.
Yeah.
This gag didn't. I think partly just because Cole is like pretending to have a dream about what we presume to be his girlfriend back home.
Yeah.
And then he's kind of giving her all this kind of baby talk and then is like looking for a kiss, and then Danny almost kisses Cole. And then that's when Cole reveals that he's not actually asleep and he's just been playing them this whole time. And it goes into this kind of weird, very 90s kind of no homo territory that I'm just that hasn't aged well. So that was one of the guys. And also it goes on for quite a long time. You're kind of like, I don't think he's asleep. You know, you kind of get the gag. way before the supposed punchline.
Yeah. Well, and then it shifts their dynamic. That's where it, so the dynamic is kind of strange, because it's not like they're, one's a criminal, one's a cop, and they slowly kind of become friends and go together over time. It's like they are already instantly playing with each other and bouncing off of each other, and then they have these moments where they try and double cross, and then they have these moments where they consider each other family, but not, and then in the next scene, and yeah, it keeps going back and forth in that sense. There's not really a gradual relationship arc.
There's not like a kind of arc where like it's very confrontational to begin with, kind of goes up and down, you know, they become more friendly. Maybe there's a moment where it looks like that one has betrayed the other, that they split apart again, and then actually it turns out they're best buds. There's no kind of like obvious arc that we usually go through. It's just like throughout they go from being like best buds to like double crossing each other to best buds to double crossing each other to best buds to double cross each other. So it's very back and forth that way. Yeah.
And so at this point, they are found again, if I'm correct, through, and this is where they do like the running through the jungle and the river.
Yes.
So stuff, that, which
this is where the
doesn't make sense geographically.
No. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But it does have the kind of cliff jump at the end of the chase.
That's
very much the kind of like scene in the movie where like everybody, when that was shot, went like, "That's going in the trailer."
Yeah. So, but what's weird about it, and this kind of goes with the editing, is so they do the cliff jump into what is clearly an ocean or a lake, some huge body of water. And then you see the reaction of the soldiers, the mercenaries, like, "Oh, we lost them." And then the next scene of Danny and Cole are them in rapids, like a river, which how would they have gotten to these rapids, jumping into kind of this large body of water?
I don't know. I presume that like we just missed a bunch of scenes where they were just swimming for a while.
And then, yeah.
So they're swimming for quite a long time. We just don't realize how long they're swimming.
Yeah.
So they swam in the sea, and then they found a tributary, and then there was a lot of swimming that we just missed. Yes, no, it's quite weird. It's quite a kind of stark kind of jump of being like, "Wait, what? Where are we?" But we've not got time for that. This movie doesn't have time for such things. We roll on.
Yes. And
so this is like, there is certain points in the movie that just busted me up laughing, and this is one of them. Was like, not so when they pop out the river, we get more classic bickering, and because like Danny lost the gun, so they've got to go and get guns, and they go and get guns from a character called Bennett, played by Sally Kirkland, and they walk in on her having a bath, and she pulls a shotgun on them that she just happens to have in the bath, and that cracked me up.
Yeah, and she calls it her rubber ducky or something.
She said, "Oh, I ran out of rubber duckies."
Yeah, there we go.
I mean, it leads to so many questions of like, why would you have a shotgun in the bath? Would the shotgun even work after being in the bath for however long? You know, like
there are so many points when they're in the water, and yeah, just in general in the water, and then having guns. Where I kept one of the notes I wrote was, would any of these guns even work anymore? Because out of all like how submerged all of them are throughout this whole thing, but what I enjoyed. Some of the bickering actually works of kind of like this back and forth banter of like when they finish out of the rapids, they're like, no, they're not being followed. Amir tries to say, he's like, "Okay, keep moving," but he's just using his hand. He doesn't actually have the gun. And so, yeah, there's this whole moment of, "Where's my gun at? That's my favorite gun. Why were you just using your hand?" And like back and forth of, like, "We just survived all that. That's not even possible. See, you're not even upset at we should be friends now, or kind of stuff like that.
That's true. And it's even like in the next scene where they're basically don't have any cash to pay Bennett, who apparently they both know.
Yeah.
So Bennett's kind of pretty blasé when they decide to stick her up and tie her up and then steal guns from her. But we get this dynamic again of so both Danny and Cole are debating what the best guns are and who knows the most about guns and all this kind of stuff and kind of mocking each other. And then, 2 seconds later, when they're sticking up Bennett, they're like best buds, totally on the same page. Riffing off each other.
Yeah. So there's a weird edit in that too, because right before they're best buds again, they pull guns on each other, and Cole has a shotgun, and it is so. Here's the thing: is in one take. So look, when the camera's at one angle. Danny has a Colt 45 or one of those clip guns. And then when it switches the view, he has a six shooter.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there's this whole another bad editing moment where not even the gun is the same that he's holding from 1 second to the other. But yeah, and then there's kind of, he makes some sexual jokes about, because he's trying to tie her up from around her instead of just her hands, and so there's more of that type of banter as well.
Yes, there is more of that type of, that is slightly creepy. That's quite funny, that joke about so he tries to tie her up around, and so there's a joke that there's not enough rope. Basically, there's not enough rope to go around her breast, and Cole rolls his eyes and goes like, "No, tie up her hands." Yeah. And there is quite a weird, creepy moment where Danny is like, "Take off your clothes," and Cole's like, "No, why? Why did what? That's not part of the plan."
Yeah,
which ends up being quite funny, despite the creepiness, because of the way the pushback from Cole and she doesn't take any of her clothes off.
Yeah.
And Bennett herself just kind of rolls her eyes, being like, "Why? What are you talking about?" And then we all just move on.
Yeah. So Armour and his mercenaries use this as an example, because he knows they're still alive, but he goes and tells Loomis, Patrick Stewart, that they died, and with them, any information on where the boat actually is kind of gone. Loomis does not believe him, and so when Armour and his crew go out to kind of find Danny again and Cole, Loomis basically tells his men to take out Armour's crew. And so, we start seeing this dynamic between them break down.
Yeah, but that's not that. I mean, that happens in a minute just after Armour and Cole, because we not really discuss Cole and Danny being captured by Armour.
Oh yes, yep.
At the bar. So we cut to a bar. We get our introduction of Izzy, played by Kadeem Hardison, who just turns up for 2 seconds at this point, and will turn up again later. And the scene in the bar is quite weird, because we have this performance by Big Daddy Kane, and we're like, ah, cool, this random bar in specific South America has a big hip hop star playing this on a Tuesday night or whatever. So that's
then then you have the patrons. It just cuts to these two guys who are like, "Oh, we should have went to Atlanta."
Yeah. And so apparently, I don't know if you know this, but so apparently those guys are Ed Lover and Dr. Dre. Not that Dr. Dre. There is two Dr. Dre's. That's something I found out yesterday. but apparently they had a show on MTV, a hip-hop show on MTV, and they were DJs that ran from the late 80s into the early 90s. I think it was 89, 95. So yeah, that's weird because we don't know who they are. I mean, probably people at the time did, particularly if they're into MTV and hip hop. But also because like they're like in this one scene. I mean, I could have had other scenes of them in the bar being the Statler and Waldorf of this movie because they're just like they're just kind of riffing on like the situation. Like, why have they come here in this shitty, run-down bar in specific South America? And also, they're just like, why does everybody have guns here? So, like, yeah. I could have done with more kind of this kind of Statler and Waldorf act that they seem to be having of just them commenting on the action as it happens.
Because but, it's only the... it cuts to them, what, three times? And that's, they're very quick blips, but then that's it.
That's it. They're only really in this one segment of the movie. We do come back to the crazy ace bar later on, a little bit later on, but they're not in that scene. That's a shorter scene in the bar.
Which would have been great if they were still there after several days or whatever, however long they were.
However long it took for both Cole and Danny Fitzgate from Armour and his people. But yes, so yeah, like you say, basically, Armour and his people capture Danny and Cole. They basically lie to Loomis, say Danny is dead, and they're going to find the boat themselves. Loomis kind of immediately catches on to this, knows something's off, and orders the deaths of Armour's men. And at Armour's kind of compound that he has, like Loomis's men's attack on Armour's compound is really quite funny because it's set up with this guy who I presume is one of Armour's men's just randomly sharpening a knife but looking super suspicious while sharpening the knife. Nobody else sees how shady he's looking. And then he just throws a knife at somebody and then like a bunch of people come from the jungle and start shooting up the place. Yeah. It's really quite funny how it's done.
Yeah, I don't even know what the purpose of the knife throwing was. Because with the, you know, the rest of the army, I guess, or whatever, of Loomis's men already kind of had them by surprise by coming out of the jungle. But yeah, it makes a fun scene.
It does make a fun scene. Also, I do feel like we missed a scene because I'm not sure. So Brenda Back's character, Maria, goes down to execute one of her fellow mercenaries, Java, who's her boyfriend, played by James Chalk. And like we're told by Dennis Leary that he's the one that Java is the one who betrayed the gang and told Loomis that they were betraying him. But I don't remember like seeing that happen or anything. Like
all we see, so it's Loomis.
Very confusing.
Yeah, because from what we see, it looks like Loomis comes to it on his own.
Yes, that was my own. That was my interpretation too.
And then at one, as they're all leaving, him and Java make eye contact, but it's very brief. But he comes to it before he even has a discussion with Java or anything.
Because Loomis, through magic powers, knows through Dennis Leary's dirty fingernails that Dennis Leary is going to betray him.
Yeah,
I don't know how that works, but I mean, so yeah, there's, I mean. I think I even missed that glance, to be honest. Like,
it is as they are leaving.
Right. Yes. I can picture it now. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not even, it's not like a glance of, oh, he's lying to you, Loomis, or anything like that. It's just kind of a, they look at each other. I don't know. But yeah, this is another moment where it feels like they were trying to make it run into a certain time frame or trying to do something and they cut out certain sections.
It does seem that way. Like maybe the betrayal was more obvious because apparently while it's never been released, there is a 97-minute version of this movie. The movie, as you can see it now, is an hour and a half. So there's 7 minutes that have gone somewhere. And apparently there was stronger violence in the original cut. And it was the cuts were mainly for violence, but I think there was some cut for profanity. I don't know if there was more sex stuff as well. I'm not sure. But I think it was mainly violence and bloodiness. But I don't know, like maybe it took some other stuff out as well in this film. Because again, it might have just been very short, you know, minute of dialogue less, you know, the betrayal happened or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. There is certain moments where things are a bit kind of confused and confusing in this movie. But yeah, so we get Cole and Danny escape. We get more Cole and Danny classic burkering. We get more falling into water. Danny has to jump out of a Danny has to jump out of a helicopter and he falls into water. And
But there is the scene of him being interrogated where they have him tied up on the helicopter. On a rope on the helicopter, and they're just dipping him in the water and pulling him out.
They're just dunking him in the water while Dennis Leary kind of riffs and.
Yeah, and he gives up the information constantly throughout. He's not like a. You know,
I mean, to be fair, if you're being drowned, give up information too. You know, like it's fair enough. I think.
Yeah.
So, yes, and, like, while, again, getting away from gunfire, like, Cole has to jump into some water as well.
Yeah.
So we meet up in a river.
Which kind of looks like,
in this movie.
It looks like the same river. But...
It does look like the same river that we were in not that long ago, all of, like, 10 to 15 minutes ago, when they last had to jump into water to escape from something.
Yeah, and it's not a deep river that they're jumping into, so I'm surprised they're not like, you know, they're doing okay and not just smashing into all of the rocks that are there.
That's true, but they always that's one of those kind of weird edit things. They always seem to be diving into deeper pools of water than they're popping up from.
Yeah.
This is one of the. This is part of the wackiness of this film.
Yeah. So they, Armour and his crew, like, well, just leave them. Whatever, we know where it's located now, and they're going to go deal with Loomis. To which, Loomis is laying flowers down for his beloved wife,
who he buried alive at the start of the movie.
And also,
we should have mentioned that we don't know if they just got married, how long they've been married, but for some reason she was buried alive in her wedding dress.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Or maybe they were just about to get married, but he did say wife, so they must have actually been married.
Yeah.
But then I was like, what, did they deliberately dress her in the wedding dress? Did they just get married and then he found out it betrayed? I have so many questions about this film.
Yeah. So basically, Armour comes up to Loomis, and Loomis thinks, oh, you're coming to apologize and ask for forgiveness. But Armour lays it out of, well, I'm more likely to, because you're in a wheelchair, whatever, I'm more likely to get the money first, and so it's going to be my money now. And all of your men can join me. And then his kind of last holdout, I guess, bodyguard, Loomis's, then decides to join Armour as well and dumps Loomis into the same grave? Or I don't know.
No, it's a different grave.
Yeah, it's a different grave.
Because they've dug an open grave, presumably for Armour.
Okay, that's what, yeah.
And this bit of the movie is real fun, because as much as Patrick Stewart has been overacting in every scene that he's been in, he really goes hell for leather in this scene. So when he is dumped into the grave, And he just goes on this mad rant about, like, you learned everything you knew from me. So look at me. Look at me now. This is you. You're looking at yourself. Ah, ha, ha, ha. And then he can't remember the Lord's Prayer. And he starts he's like, oh, yeah, no, I need to be praying at this time. This seems like a good time to pray. Ah, but I can't remember the lines. Ah, Jesus.
So he's supposed to be dead. And yet you see his hand kind of burst through all the rubble. And it's still moving. You don't see it like flop over or anything. You see it kind of moving.
Yeah, it's just a proper kind of carry moment.
Yeah. You're like, so is he dead? Or is he going to pop back up again later? I don't know.
Try to come back for Gunmen too.
Yeah. I mean, everything else is doing the sequel reboot. So I suggest a Gunmen 2. 30 years later.
30 years later. That's insane. Mind you, right? I mean, there is like direct-to-DVD, like completely unrelated sequels that have just taken the title of a movie and then been like, what, such and such two, like years later. Like,
yeah.
There was like, I found out last year of just looking at IMDb credits of random things that there's like a Bulletproof 2 that was made in like 2018.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, like, like Dolph Lundgren starred in a Kindergarten Cop 2, completely unrelated, in 2016. You know, like, I don't know, Gunmen 2, you know, a movie that nobody remembers, but like, But why not? Why not? And then it would just be completely unrelated, terrible.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they get to Izzy. Yeah. They get to Izzy again, Cole and, Danny, and so they're on the plane, and this is the point where I was probably what we talked about in the beginning, going, oh, this has to be over by now. Oh, okay, so it's still 50 minutes or somehow I don't know where that time all goes, but then so they're in the plane and they kind of have a heart-to-heart where I think this is where Danny says the thing about, I don't have any family anymore. You don't have a family. So basically we can be family together. And Cole also reveals that despite what everybody's been saying of Danny's brother, it being said that Danny's brother was coming back to basically save Danny and so they could run away with the money, that I guess Danny's brother was actually coming back to kill him.
It doesn't seem to have any hard information on this. This seems to be a hypothesis to bomb Danny out, you know?
And so then Danny's disheartened and then he kind of goes, oh, I could be wrong. What's the purpose of that line for anyways?
Although it is quite a fun scene, this.
Yeah.
Because I did quite like, I could have done with more Izzy in the film.
Yeah.
Izzy's quite a fun character. And when they're having this heart to heart, like Izzy starts telling the story about his dad in a James Bond wig and him and the James Brown wig and then him taking the James Brown wig and running about and all this kind of stuff. And then they just both look at him and they're like, what? And he's like, hey, I just want to, you know, I want to be part of this heart to heart too. Yeah. And then they just both point their guns at them and he's like, oh, man. which I did make me laugh. I was like, so there's lots of moments that are unintentional that made me laugh, but there's also these moments that are completely intentional that made me laugh too.
Oh, but I guess another random scene that is kind of, it feels like there might have been more to it, but then now feels like a throwaway scene in the version of the movie we get. The guy that had a good kind of raised Cole is what he insinuates. The chief is, after Cole's father died, he gets killed by one of the other workers at the
one DA, of the DA.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does seem like this might have been more of a subplot, but it just comes out of nowhere. Basically, we're introduced to, at the DEA camp, we're introduced to this character, Rance, in like one scene. He's completely undistinguished, you know, like what? Completely indescript. And just seems like a throwaway character. Seems like a character we'll never see again. Then, about, I don't know, like 40 minutes into the movie, we get this one random scene where Rance and the Chief Chavez are in a car, and Chief Chavez starts talking about how they've got a mole in the camp, and it becomes very obvious that Rance is a mole, and then Rance kills the chief, and we're like, this is, I don't know, like, I mean, well, there's only 7 minutes kind of the film. I don't know how much they could have developed this subplot in that time. Given that I believe that most of the edits were due to violence. So, like, yeah, I mean, like, this subplot is, they either shouldn't have it in the film, or they should have had, like, given it, like, 10 to 15 minutes more. Yeah. But, you know, it just feels very shoehorned in that it's like this.
Yeah.
And it does, it's unnecessary as well, because, like, we've got all our players, you know, the only people we really need is Armor and his gang, Loomis, and then like Danny and Colt. Like, we don't need this other thing, you know, where, you know, I get it. They're trying to throw it in because it's like everybody's double crossing each other. Let's throw in just a random other double cross. But it does feel extremely unnecessary.
Yeah, because he didn't actually, it's not like he helped any of Armor's searching. You know, he doesn't really play a role in being a good mole, I guess, in the investigation. They knew all the information without his help, I feel like.
Yeah, they pretty much got all the information they needed without him.
Yeah.
And then, like, so when they go to Mexico, and of course they go to Mexico by jumping out of a plane to land in more water, because that's this film's favorite thing, people jumping out of things, landing in water.
Yeah.
Yeah, like by the time they hook up Armor and his gang, again with Rance, like they've got all the information, and they got all the information themselves. The only information, I guess, that they got from Rance was that Cole was on their tail, but they probably would have figured that out soon enough.
And that Cole has the name of the boat, I think, is the only, because...
Yeah. I think that's the only information that they got from him. And... I don't know. They probably could have figured that out themselves probably pretty quickly once they captured Cole and Danny.
Yeah.
It just all seems a bit kind of convoluted and you don't really need it. Although, I guess there is a fun payoff to it, because it does allow Mario Van Peebles to have a cool moment where Rance, like, overplays his hand and exposes himself as a mole, and then Mario Van Peebles just kicks him off a balcony, and I was like, oh, that's pretty funky, pretty cool.
And it does the repeat kick shot where it's like he does the one kick, but then you see it go about three times, the same kick.
Yeah. It's real good. It's classic martial art movie stuff. Yeah. I'm always very into it.
Yeah. So we get there, and this is where, again, another double cross happens that is very easily forgiven, of that they get up on shore. Cole is the one carrying the bag. Danny grabs the bag, starts to take out the guns, then throws Cole a first aid kit and says, well, I don't want you running away, and then shoots him in the leg. But it's not like he shoots him in the leg and leaves him.
Oh, yeah, no.
No, they still go, like, are working together.
He's still working together. It's just so he can't run away. And I guess, like, that moment seemed so random to me, because it seemed like, because they had that heart-to-heart, I was like, oh, now they're definitely both on the same page. Oh, no, we're still doing the double-crossing bullshit, right? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I guess, like, the next scene did make me laugh, though. Because when they're still together, and like Danny is taking him to the hotel room, like Cole is telling Danny off about how stupid it was to shoot him in the leg because he could have killed him. Like, there's tendons and arteries there. Yeah. He goes like, man, there's tendons and arteries. But the thing that he says after that is, and also I play basketball. And I wrote in my notes, this is a weird time to be worrying about your pickup game.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
This is a random thing to put in there. And I play basketball. Yeah, okay.
And then what ends up happening is that when Danny then knocks Cole out and takes the gun, which he hides under his shirt unsuccessfully, to leave because he double crossed him again, even though Cole forgave him about the leg shooting.
He forgave them because he got his own back and shot him in the leg.
So it's
evens now.
So now they're both shot in the leg.
Exactly. Lambert's reaction to that was good.
Yeah.
Because like what Lambert did to Van Peebles was he threw him a first aid kit and then shot him in the leg.
Yeah.
And then Cole throws the first aid kit back in the later scene, and like Lambert goes, ah shit. Yeah. And his facial reaction's real funny.
And then one of the things about it is both of them know they have to take on all of these mercenaries, and so you're kind of going, why would you shoot each other in the leg now?
That's exactly what I thought as well. It's the dumbest move in the world. It's like now we've deliberately made it harder to get this mission done.
Yeah. And so, he knocks him out. Then he gets captured by Maria and them. And he spills the name that Cole gave him. The name of the boat was called the Killer. He tells them, but they're going to kill him anyways out on the dock. And this is where Maria, even though she didn't really do this before, it seems like she has a weird sexual attraction to Danny.
Yeah, this kind of comes out of nowhere. Yeah. It just so when they captured Danny again, all of a sudden he's kind of like, ooh, if only we could get it on kind of thing. But we can't because I have to kill you now. And it's like, wait, the first time you captured them, I don't remember any of this kind of... It's weird. It's like she goes from just being like this kind of psychopath character who just wants to kill people to this kind of psychosexual kind of killer, like, you know, like Famke Janssen's character in GoldenEye type thing. But the psychosexual thing only really happens in this last, like, 20 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, that's kind of great. Okay.
And so, they're going to kill him. And she says the thing about she uses her gun as a dick, basically. And then he says the thing that he doesn't swallow, and they all laugh. All the mercenaries and her. So it's like they have a good laugh. And then Cole starts...
Yeah, it's good that he threw them off that way. They just all stood about and chuckled at that. And again, we do get another classic Lambert laugh, so that's always worth it.
But then they start getting picked off by Cole, who, despite everything, is still, I guess, the good guy and willing to help out Danny. And Maria is shot, but unlike the rest, she's only shot in the shoulder. And then, basically, Cole and Danny hobble to a boat called the Matador, so it's not called the Killer. And it's just this large boat that they head out on. But then there's the scene of, I guess it's not really important, but it is now, of Danny cannot read. And so they're basically hot wiring this boat. Cole is handling the wires, and he's dealing with a tarantula that is now under the wires as well. And then he's trying to explain to Danny how to read, how to know what the word ignition looks like by holding up your finger, and the letter I looks like your finger. So choose the one that starts with the letter that looks like your finger.
Yeah, I think like they just didn't have him reading so they could have this scene. Because yeah. Like, when it first comes up that like Danny can't read, I was like, oh, this seems like a random subplot of like, why is this here? And it's like, oh, yeah. So they can have this scene. So it just adds that little bit of extra jeopardy of like yeah. getting the ignition in time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's all quite weird and silly, but they managed to get it going. We still have basically all the mercenaries are dead now, apart from Armor and Maria. Pretty much every, because Loomis is dead, Loomis's gang is dead. All of Armor's mercenaries are dead, apart from Maria. So it's just Armor, Maria, Cole, and Danny, and that's our final four. Everybody else is very much dead.
Yeah.
And then, so basically, they pair off. Danny has to fight Maria. Cole has to fight Armor. And I was surprised that Maria, who at this point had, I mean, Maria's intelligence is kind of like up and down throughout the film. Like sometimes she seems like a very tactically aware kind of soldier. And sometimes she seems like a psychopathic idiot. And so, but in the end, it is the idiot side that comes through. And she falls for Danny's very obvious trick of placing boots on a higher level of the boat as if he was lying down. But of course, the boots are empty. And Danny harpoons her. Through her like other shoulder, so she just, but like she's still alive because at this point we've discovered that Maria is pretty much the Terminator, I think.
Yeah,
like because she survived a lot throughout the movie in terms of injuries, but then so have Cole and Danny. So maybe everybody's Wolverine in this movie. Who knows? The thing that I wanted to point out about the fight between Cole and Armor is, and I guess the film was made, it was shot in 1992, so I guess this was very relevant at the time. They have Dennis Leary make this very awkward jive where he is kicking Cole, and then he says, "You know what I feel like right now? Like a member of the LAPD." And this is when the fight changes and Cole gets on top, because that comment just like fires him up so much that he manages to switch it around.
And then the fight is, so Cole gets kicked a lot, but once he flips it around, it goes pretty fast. Like he just smashes.
Oh yeah, he just absolutely
armor
surprises Dennis Leary. But it makes sense because I was like, "What?" Because you look at, I think it does. It's good that, you know, again, it's kind of convenient for the film that Cole was shot in the leg by Danny, because I think if he hadn't been shot in the leg, a one-on-one fight between Dennis Leary and Mario Van Peebles just looks kind of silly, of being like, of course Mario Van Peebles is going to destroy this guy. Like, So I think that it's good that Armor gets the drop on him. So he comes in and then he just like pounces on him, and B, that like Cole is injured. Because if it was just like a straight off fight, I think it would look maybe a little silly for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So he runs away and he's yelling for Danny and telling Danny to get off the boat. And in that amount of time, because Danny's not really, he's hearing him but asking why, Cole is shot by Armor, which causes him to fall into the water. Danny jumps in after him to save him, apparently. And then Armor ends up, well, he goes over to Maria asks if she's going to make it. She says she is, but he says, well, no, or, no, you're not, or something. He ends up killing her so he can get all the money. And he goes to see the money, or see where the money's at. But what he finds is a bomb that Nicole placed. And I know this was your favorite part. So
this is one of my favorite parts in the movie. We've discussed many of my other favorite parts of the movie. I love them to do, all of them Lambert based. But when Dennis Leary, and this is genuinely one of the most cartoonish, goofiest villain moments I've seen in an action movie, it ranks very high. And it's probably one of the best villain best we have seen since Michael Caine was thrown off that thrown into a bunch of oil in that platform and on deadly ground. So Dennis Leary looks straight into the camera, kind of breaking the fourth wall type moment, and just goes, "Fuck me!" And then the boat blows up, and I was absolutely slain by that. I was watching this myself. I laughed out loud. I had to pause the movie. I busted up so much of this. I thought it was great. I genuinely thought oh, that is genius. So yeah, again, you know, some people don't appreciate that sort of goofiness in an action movie. I'm very pro goofiness. I'm on board. I am on board with what they, you know, because like up until that, you know, like because throughout the movie, there's been kind of ups and downs, and I was like, yeah, this isn't a particularly good movie, but I am enjoying it, and then that really pushed over the top of like, yeah, it's maybe technically it's choppily edited, the plot's kind of silly, characters are kind of silly, the acting's very over the top, but you know what? Fuck it.
It's yeah. That's the motto of the theme of this movie by the end. So kind of what we have then is Danny is yelling for Cole, and he's saying, I don't even care about the money, apparently, which is different than the 2 minutes
the
prior.
Of the movie.
Yeah. I just want you, Brent, and then Cole turns out to be alive, and then they swim back to shore, which then Cole reveals the, or they talk about what they would do with their half. So even though Cole is supposed to be the good guy, he is still going to use the money for himself, but he was going to make it do something with charity.
Yes, and, I thought it's a bit of a confusing scene. First, like, the movie does a very poor job of trying to convince us that Cole might kill Danny and then take off with the money. It's like, there's been double crosses, but he's never double crossed him for the money. He's just like, sweet to keep him in the investigation. So that didn't make a lot of sense. I was like, that's obviously a fake out thing. And of course it is. He just cuts the rope to launch them off on the boat. And then, yeah, it's a bit confusing because up to this point, he seemed like very much like the kind of straight-laced kind of hero guy. So I very much thought that like Danny would say like, this is my money. Like, we got to take our money. And then he would say like, no, this is the money of the United States government. We got to take it back to base kind of thing. You know, because he'd been that straight-laced up to this point. But he's instead like, no, we go halfsies. And I'm like, so you're just like retired now and you're just going to be a millionaire, give some to charity. Okay, cool. Yeah. So that's it. That's it. That's the end of the movie. They just go half season and that's it. And we got another nice song.
The boat is called Gunmen.
Of course. I mean, you always got to appreciate that. They didn't actually say the name of the movie in the movie, but they got the name of the movie in the movie, so well done then. Because again, when it was cut into credits, and then the name of the back of the boat, Gunmen. I was like, well done. Of course. Yeah. Of course that's what it's called.
And they have one last kind of gag where Cole is saying, no, this box is my money. You'll have a different one during the split, and we kind of see Danny trying to pocket some of it, but then he has to take it out because of Cole, and then he's trying to sneakily kind of pocket it again. And yeah, and that's it.
So that is Gunman in the book. That's all covered. I think, unless you had any other notes that you wanted to bring up.
I don't. I think we covered as much as possible for the movie.
Yeah, I think we pretty much covered. I think we pretty much covered everything. I think possibly the only thing we didn't cover is there is a scene right near the start of the movie where, like, we basically establish that Danny's a good guy, because Armour and his men kill a couple who are part of the drug trade, but then leave their daughter presumably to starve. And then Danny picks the daughter up and drops her off at a nunnery. So that kind of, that kind of stuff.
Which, when they're talking about what they would do with the money, Danny does say,
yeah,
that he would give her some of the money.
There is a callback to, because Cole's like, oh, look, we'll have to drop some of this money off at the nunnery. And then Danny says, oh, I thought I was just going to FedEx it. And he was like, no, we're going to deliver it.
Yeah.
So that was only other, because again, that was quite a random moment where I guess they didn't want Dennis Leary killing a kid. Maybe thought that was a bit too mean-spirited. But, I mean, he is still essentially leaving her to die, so it's kind of just as cruel. I think the movie is trying to escape the cruelness of killing a child, but is really just doing something equally cruel, even though obviously the movie has the child saved to a possible brutal education in the nunnery. But who knows? Maybe it's a very good nunnery. We shouldn't just assume things. Anyway, I think that is pretty much everything covered in Gunman now. So it's just time for final thoughts. So overall kind of thoughts on the movie. Would you recommend this movie to people? Have we discovered a lost classic?
I don't know about Lost Legacy. We've kind of mentioned, there is something, again, the editing, really bad. But there is something really fun about it, of just because they're all committing to it. They know what type of movie they're in. It's very silly. And so I'd say it's like, if you can find it and you have nothing else to watch and you just want something you can, I don't know, not background noise, but, you know, enjoy and not put too much thought into, or things like that, one night and you can't think of anything else to watch, then yeah, check it out.
Yeah.
It's great Lambert and, yeah, and peak of his kind of persona.
It is. I would say it definitely is. I think Lambert is great in it. He gives one of his most insane, most committed performances,
yes,
in this film, in terms of just really going all out and pushing it to the kind of outrageous. He's just laughing it up the whole time. He's eating bugs. He's like doing wacky things. So just for the Lambert-ness of it all, I think it's worth a watch. I would say that if you are looking for what would be considered a conventionally good film, this is maybe not it. It's not necessarily a good film in that, yes, it is ripping off Lethal Weapon and The Good, Bad, and Ugly at the same time. Yes, the plot is paper thin. Yes, all the characters are pretty two-dimensional. One-dimensional in some cases. Yes, it's all very silly and goofy. But it is. And also, yes, we've mentioned a bunch of times about the choppy editing. But it is fun. And some of the weirdness of it is part of the kind of magic of the movie, of those random scenes of hip-hop's really popular now. We're going to shoehorn a couple of scenes where, like, known rappers of the time are in them, rapping. Because, yes, we're just doing that, you know, because that's popular. So that weirdness, and the things like Bennett having the shotgun in the bath. And, like, yeah, all of Danny's craziness from his opening scene, eating the fly, all the things he does throughout the movie. It's just a fun watch. And I think it's the kind of film that a lot of people will just watch it and be like, well, that wasn't such a good movie. But if you are an action fan, which presumably if you're listening to this podcast, you are, it is kind of like a perfect, like, movie with friends, beer and a pizza, kind of Friday night,
exactly.
Like, kind of throw it on kind of movie. You know, like, it's not a classic, but you'll have a fun time.
Yeah, that's it. I was going to say it's like a beer and junk food movie type of thing. And then I will say that, you know, yeah, it's on the lower end of a lot of what we've watched so far on this podcast. But I think in terms of the funness, it might be one of the most fun ones, even though it's probably one of the the least well crafted ones, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it's just because of this is a movie that most reminds me of the Steven Seagal season, where mm-hmm. there's a lot of those Steven, like a film like On Deadly Ground, which is a bad movie, probably worse than this movie. But it, like, because of all the weird choices, because of all the wackiness, like, and because it just goes for things. And it's just like, there's lots of things where it just breezes through. There's lots of plots and subplots that is just breezing through and then being like, you know, you might think to yourself, like, are you going to get any answer for this? And the movie's like, no, fuck it. We roll on. And like, and that's it. And that's the movie's attitude. Just kind of, fuck it. We'll throw in this shit. Like, yeah, we're going to have like two MTV VJs who were popular at the time, who nobody knows now, you know, doing a Statler and Waldorf routine in this wacky bar that apparently has really high level hip hop acts, even though it's in like the Amazon jungle or some shit. Like, yeah. I don't know. Like, we're just doing things and it just goes to bat. And it's like, I appreciate that. It's just like, oh, we're going all out. And I think kind of the movie knows what it is. Like, I think certainly the actors in the movie know exactly what it is. And so everybody's just having fun with it. And then I appreciate that. There's no attempt to be serious. Even the kind of serious moments of the movies, like that kind of weird Peckinpah bit where the bride getting buried and stuff like that. It's all done so goofily that you're like, you can't really take any of it seriously. And I don't think the movie really wants you to. I just think it's fun. I did see, like, I didn't find much background details on this movie, apart from the thing about the, you know, the different version and stuff like that. But I did see a very sour Siskel and Ebert review for it on YouTube. And they just really shat on it. And like, and they were like, and the thing is, right, I can understand them slagging off this movie in the terms of like the shonky editing, the you know, the paper thin plot, the over the top ridiculous characters, some of the acting, all these kind of things. Like, I can, but I'm sure at one point one of them says it's boring, and I'm like, really? You watch this movie? This wacky ass, everything explodes movie? Like, everybody's jumping in the water movie? And it was like, that's dull? I was like, I don't know, man. Like, that's pretty lively. Yeah, that's the one thing I would not accuse this movie of. I would never accuse it of being boring. I think it is highly watchable, you know, junky cinema. And if you're into that, then I would I would check it out. It's like we said, we've not dug up a lost classic, a kind of forgotten film. No, I guess it was forgotten for a reason. It's quite a silly, not very good movie, but it is fun. And like I said, if you're in the States, it is available on Tubi for free. So, like, you know, you've not got anything to lose. You're just going to have a fun thing with Christopher Lambert and Mario Van Peebles bickering with each other, which I think, yeah, certainly watchable.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, yes, unless you have anything else to say about the movie, we'll cut to the plugs of what you're doing, what you're up to elsewhere, Craig, apart from this podcast, which is obviously at the top of your list, yeah. Like, you know, the most important things you have to do. But other things that are slightly lower down in the list, what's happening there?
So as of right now, we took a bit of a hiatus, and I think I've kind of talked about it a little bit, but I do a podcast. Another one but around horror called Bloodhound Picks, and we should be releasing kind of our just a new episode. And we kind of completely shifted the format, where before it was focusing on independent independent artists and obscure horror films of yesteryear, but now we're really looking at the process of what does it mean to be an independent filmmaker, and how could you make your own movie, and really going through all the steps to hopefully help others in that sense. And then the other thing, that by the time this episode airs, I should be wrapped up with, is the project that I've been working on called I'm the Joke, which is a comedy special that is kind of discusses the idea around offensiveness in live comedy, and how we can communicate better as different within different groups of people to kind of handle these subjects better in the future, instead of, you know, they being so combative about it. Hopefully, is what the goal of it is, to just open up that discussion. But yeah, it should be
a very
be,
noble
yeah.
goal indeed. I'm very yeah. much looking forward.
Yeah, and I should be performing that at a couple different places. And I'm hopefully, well, you're in New Zealand now, Scott, but yeah, looking at there's a school in the UK that is potentially interested in me performing it out there and stuff like that. But yeah, we'll see. I'll keep you updated.
Wow. That's very exciting. And yeah, I'd love to see it. I mean, you know, every May there is a New Zealand comedy festival that happens. You could do that. And I'd be very cool. And I would certainly recommend it to all my friends and family back home if you took it to the Edinburgh Fringe, which, as everybody knows, is the greatest comedy festival in the world. Take that, Montreal Just for Laughs and Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Edinburgh, greatest fringe, greatest comedy festival in the world. I said it.
Yeah.
So I certainly recommend it to all my people back home. And as for myself, if you want to listen to more of me talk about other things that are not action related, you can at New Horror Express. That's my fortnightly podcast where I interview horror movie directors, writers, actors. I even talk to a festival organizer for a film festival here in New Zealand. So talk to all sorts of people working in modern indie horror today. Yeah, you can find that wherever you find podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. And if you want to, if you've got any thoughts or opinions on this episode or any of our episode, any of our back catalogues of this show, you can always hit us up at 90s Action. Or if you want to, you know, say something to me personally, you can hit me up at ScottMurphy85. That is all for this time. But be sure to join us next time, next month, when we will be talking about another possibly great action movie from 1993. Who knows? Who knows? We just, it's always a lucky dip with this podcast. It could be a childhood favorite. It could be a completely random bad movie. So you never know. But come and join us next month, where we'll be talking more 1993 action. Until then, though, see ya.